Listen, everyone, you're getting back from your break between Claudine Helmuth and Michael Bungie-Stanier, day 6 of the Smartest Health Summit 2008, and I am Ariane Goodwin, your host and moderator for this one and only professional art career conference, online or off. Please visit us and find out what we're up to, www.smartest-telesummit.com. That's S-M-Artist, A-R-T-I-S-T. Our second guest of day 6 is the founder of BoxOfCrayons.biz, a company that works with organizations and teams around the world. He has created a coaching program called GetUnstuckAndGetGoing.com, as well as a couple of amazing internet movies, which I can't tell you how much fun, Michael, I had watching these movies. The 8 Irresistible Principles of Fun and the 5 3/4 Questions You've Been Avoiding. In fact, I contacted Michael after I'd watched the 5 3/4 Questions You've Been Avoiding because I wanted to do an internet movie. He warned me off due to the complexity and the cost, but they're so much fun. Go see them and sign up for his biweekly newsletter, Outside the Lines. You'll be joining 40,000 other subscribers. You know, I asked Michael to present at Smartest in the hope that he could shake up and shoo away some of the sacred art cows that might be milling about and stalling us out on the road we are all trying to take to our successful careers, be we emerging artists, mid-career artists, or advanced. His presentation today is From Amateur to Professional, Don't Let the Amateur Fool You. It could also pertain to an advanced level artist, 12 levers to move your art from the hobby it isn't to the business you want. Michael, I am just delighted you could be with us this year.
Well, look, I'm very excited to be here. I've really enjoyed the panel we had before and the preview call we did together. So I think this is the third time I'm showing up on the phone for this and really looking forward to it.
Oh, I'm so great. Do you want me to come back and try to take questions? When I just popped off now, it sounded like the line was going to be too difficult to do that, or should we just do it by email afterwards?
I think probably email afterwards. I've got quite a lot of stuff to cover in 45 minutes, so I'm going to be
packing it in.
Packing it in, exactly.
There's nobody after you, so if you need to take a few extra minutes, you certainly can do that.
Okay,
if people need to jump off on time, they can come back and listen to the recording anyway.
And Erin, just tell me, I know I put together a PDF document for this. Do people have that? Have they downloaded it?
They do. They've had access to that since the first day of the telesummit.
Wonderful.
So hopefully that's what they've done because it is an outline for you. And if they haven't, they'll have to catch up later.
Excellent.
Okay. I'm going to go listen with the rest of them and I'll be back a few minutes before the end.
Sounds great.
Okay. I'm turning them over to you, Michael.
Thank you. So welcome, everybody. I'm very grateful that you're here. I know that you've probably been accumulating a whole ton of wisdom over the last couple of weeks as you participated in the forum. And I know that this is the last session for the day, so I appreciate your patience and your willingness to hang in there. So my 45 minutes with you is called From Amateur to Professional, 12 levers to differentiate your art and move it from a hobby to a business. And as Ariane sort of intimated, my goal is to stir things up a little bit, be a little provocative, piss a few people off, because I want you to be successful. And my take on the tiny, tiny bit I know about the art world, and I know very little, so I'm making vast assumptions here, but what I see in a range of different industries, particularly the coaching industry, which is the one I know best, is that there is an awful lot of mediocre sameness. And if you want to turn your art into a business, so this is only if you really want to go professional about this, mediocre sameness is not going to hack it. Now, the good news is I think there are different ways to think about how you think about your business, and this isn't writing a business plan, this is thinking about your business model, that can give you some creativity and some thoughts about what you might do differently. But what I want mainly to shift, this is the starting point, this is what is essential to starting this journey or maybe continuing this journey, is a shift of perspective about how you see yourself. And the shift of perspective is this: you need to stop thinking of yourself as an artist. What you need to do is start thinking of yourself as an entrepreneur who sells art. or an entrepreneur who creates art. And therein lies a world of difference. It may sound like semantics, but if you are an artist, what you do is you worry about the technical aspects of your art. You know, how well am I painting? You know, how good is my sculpture? How sharp are my photographs? How artistically created are they? But if you're an entrepreneur, you start thinking about a bigger picture, which is not just what am I creating, but how am I getting it out into the world? How am I making a living or partially a living from that? So that shift from entrepreneur, from artist to entrepreneur is so significant, and I'm certain you've heard some great stuff over the last little while around just how you might go about doing that. Now, let me talk a bit about the importance of being different. Now, I'm not sure if any of you have seen The Life of Brian. It's a Monty Python movie that came out 10 years ago, perhaps. And it is about, well, it's a sort of homage and parody of religion. And the hero at one stage, Brian, who has been mistaken for the Messiah, and the movie is all about this confusion, is in front of an enormous crowd of people who've just started to follow him. And he says to this crowd, look, you're all individuals. And as one, in the same voice, in the same way, the crowd yells back, yes, we're all individuals. And that is one way of seeing the art scene. A lot of people who say, yes, we're all individuals, but they're doing it in exactly the same way, in exactly the same feel, and exactly the same look as everybody else who's yelling, hey, we're all individuals. And so it's not enough to be good at your art anymore. Because I bet of the 800 people on this phone call, 790 are really good at the art that they do, and the other 10 think they're really good at the art they do. So being good as an artist just doesn't cut it anymore if you want to make a business of it. What you have to do is you have to think about other things, how to do them differently. And part of the inspiration for this was an article I found about 3 months ago in the newspaper, and I'm going to read a little bit of it to you. Because if they can do it with this product, you can do it with your art, okay? And the title of this short article is Round Carrot That Is Perfect Shape for Children's Lunchboxes. And it starts, spherical carrots targeted at children's lunchboxes will be available in London supermarkets this week. Called Parisian carrots, they go on sale at Marks & Spencer stores for £1.45 for 300 grams. Blah, blah, blah. A carrot that needs neither peeling nor chopping will be welcomed with open arms. Children like to eat mini versions of fruit and vegetables. And so it goes on. In other words, somebody has figured out how to differentiate a carrot. A carrot. And are you telling me that you, as an artist or a sculptor or a photographer, can't find a way to differentiate your art? I do not believe it. And I'm going to help you by giving you these 12 levers that make up what makes up a business plan, a business model, so you can think about how to differentiate your art. And I'm going to give you some examples of companies who are doing this successfully. Because I do not want you to think you have to figure this all out by yourself. What I want you to work out is there are examples all around you of people who are doing smart things with their business model. Look at it, figure it out, and steal it. I don't know if you know the quote from somebody that says, originality is just unacknowledged plagiarism. I want you to be stealing these good ideas, and I want to give you some of them today. So really quickly, and for those of you who have the handout, we're on to slide 6. What is a business model? Well, it is not that scary. There are 4 main components to what a business model is. Who? In other words, who is this for? What need does this art answer? How are you going to help somebody? Who are you targeting? It is, in a word which I'm sure you've heard at least once in this art summit, a niche or a niche. So there's the who. Secondly, what? What are you promoting? What exactly is it that you are selling? And if all you are thinking about is, it's my art, it's my picture, it's my sculpture, it's my photograph, it's my whatever else, then you're too limited in how you're thinking about it. Thirdly, is the how. And this is, how do I get my art out into the world? what format, what channels do I use to actually find ways to access the people who I'm trying to sell this to? And the very fourth quadrant is how much. How much do I sell my art for? And what's cool about this model is if you start in a quadrant, it actually can take you on a different journey to think about how you promote your art. So what most people do, what most of us do, is that we start in the what, i.e. we start with our painting. I'm just going to use painting as a shorthand for artists because it's just faster and easier and I've got a limited amount of time. You start on the what, then you might think about the who, and you don't ever really think too hard about how to differentiate yourself around the how and the how much. So like I say, I'm going to do my best to give you some new examples and new questions to think differently about your art and give you some examples of companies who are doing some cool things around that. So let me start with, and on slide 7 you'll see the 12 levers that we're actually going to touch upon over the next half an hour or so. So let me start with the who. And I think there are three different levers for you to be considering as you think about who are you trying to target with your art. Okay, here are the three: people who are ignored, people who are bored, and then specific niches or niches that you want to target. And I'll give you an example of each, of a company that's doing something cool in each one of those levers. So people who are ignored. Now, I hope some of you have heard of the Grameen Bank, because the founder of the Grameen Bank, Muhammad Yunus, has created a bank for the poor. That's actually their tagline, banking for the poor, because he realized that traditional banks were ignoring the poor as a potential customer. So he said to himself, this was his starting question, this is an ignored group of people. How could I create banking in a way that would serve them and be a successful business? And he came up with the concept of microfinancing, which, you know, has got a lot of press over the last 2 or 3 years in particular, particularly since he won the Nobel Peace Prize. So, of course, as you think about your art, it is worth thinking about who are the people at the moment who are ignored as a potential audience for your art. And what do you need to start doing to start targeting and making your art attractive and feasible to that ignored audience in a way that can potentially make money for you, make a living for you? So that's the first lever, ignored. The second one is bored. So I don't know if any of you anybody else on this line enjoys a gin and tonic, but I love gin and tonic, particularly in the summer. And here's the thing with gin. Gin is basically all the same. Doesn't matter if it's Gordon's or it's Beefeater's or it's whatever. You know, it's all pretty much on a blind tasting. You have to be a heavy drinker of gin to be able to really tell the difference. And you look at the bottles are all the same. You know, they're clear glass bottles. It's a white liquid. It's got some sort of vaguely English-sounding looking label on it. It's pretty much an undifferentiated market. And then along comes something called Hendrick's Gin. Now, I love Hendrick's Gin for about 28 different reasons. One is it tastes different. Whereas most gins have like juniper berries as their main flavor, Hendrick's talks about their gin tasting of cucumbers and rose petals. So immediately that's cool. Secondly, the gin comes in a brown squat bottle with sort of cool, gothic, Edward Gorey type lettering on it. But here's what they say about their marketing. This is their tagline. Hendrick's Gin, preferred by 1 in 1,000 gin drinkers. 1 in 1,000 gin drinkers. So for me, even if I didn't like that gin, I would drink that gin because I'm like, I'm special, I'm unique. I have a certain sensibility that nobody can understand and nobody can replicate, and they're targeting me as a 1 in 1,000 gin drinker. So part of it, you think about your art, which is to say, who is bored with the stuff that is out there at the moment? who's looking for something different, something interesting, and how can you pitch, promote, create your art so that it's going to appeal to that broad group of people in a way that you can sell it for a certain amount of money that will make a living for you. And then finally, let me tell you about another artist. This is in the niching lever, number three. And I want to tell you about a band called Pearl Jam. Now, I hope some of you have heard of Pearl Jam. They're a successful band. I think they're still going. Anyway, typically for a band, rock and roll band, they release, what, one album a year, maybe one album every 2 years, for some one album every 10 years. Well, in the span of 2 years, Pearl Jam released 72 albums, and every single one of those albums made them money. And what they did is they sold those albums only through their membership-only website for people who were Pearl Jam fanatics. So they targeted a niche, people who were obsessed with Pearl Jam. And what they did is they recorded every single one of their concerts and released every single one of their concerts as a separate album. And it made them money. Because they said to themselves, how do we service this niche? People who are obsessed by this band, who will basically buy anything that comes along. By targeting the niche, by thinking more specifically about the who, they're able to think about how do we create a package of stuff that'll make them money. So that's the who. Let me tell you about the what. And the what I know is the comfortable place for everybody, because that's what you do. You produce stuff. You're artists. But there's ways of differentiating the what, and there are three levers here. The first lever is the content. The second lever is process. And the third lever is design. So content, process, and design. And I think we're now onto slide 9 if you're using the handout. So let me tell you an example of content. There is a tea bag company called Dilmah. And Dilmah actually is based in Sri Lanka, what was formerly Ceylon. And the founder of Dilmah said to himself, we are in trouble here because tea has become a commodity. You know, a tea bag is a tea bag is a tea bag. You don't really know what's in it. It's sort of some dusty, flaky tea stuff. It all tastes pretty much the same. What can we do to make that different? And in creating Dilmah, he has created a premium tea. He talks about premium leaves from Ceylon grown in, you know, shaded, hand-picked tea orchards, whatever the right word for where you grow tea is. And he has actually found a way to say, we are selling tea for 50% markup on a regular tea bag in a way that actually focuses on the quality of the content. So he's actually picked the content and said, how do we differentiate it? How do we make it stand out from everything else that's out there? Secondly, let me tell you about process. Now, I know you will have heard of IKEA, and you should pay attention to IKEA, because the guy who owns and founded IKEA is the richest man in the world, so he's obviously doing something right. And the process, what of course is so brilliant about IKEA is it's flat pack furniture, meaning you have to construct it yourself. Now, what's brilliant about that is self-constructed means that they can sell it for a lower price. It means it's different from everything else that's out there. They, in Europe, IKEA is responsible for 30% of the market share in their price range of furniture. That is an enormous amount of furniture and a very successful business. And, of course, even if I wanted to get into flat-pack furniture now, there's no way I could do it because IKEA owns that space. So what they did is they thought about the second niche. They thought about the what. And they thought about the process behind that. And they did something cool, which is like the process isn't that you get your furniture ready-made. The process is you have to put it together by yourself. And here's the third lever in this second quadrant, which is around design. And the people who are calling in from the UK, and maybe Europe as well, will know of a store there called Muji, M-U-J-I. It's originally Japanese. And Muji in Japan, in Japanese, it means no brand. And what they have done is they have built their entire business around a very austere selection of pencils and pens and drawing-y things and clothing and furniture and notepads. And it's all about a certain design aesthetic. So they've gone very strong on the design aesthetic. And, of course, what happens is when you start on one of these levers, then the successful companies are actually using a number of the different quadrants to differentiate and strengthen their business model. So you can imagine Muji starting by saying, what if we made out the design something extraordinary? Well, what would that mean who we appeal to? And if we appeal to this sort of person, what does that mean in terms of how we have to get it out to them? And if we have to get it out to them that way, what does that mean in terms of how much we can charge for this? So those are the first two quadrants, the who and the what. And my bet is if you've thought about this at all, those are the two quadrants you probably thought the most about. And remember, what I'm trying to give you here is levers, is examples of people who are doing things differently as a way of successfully growing a business and making money from it. Because I'm speaking to you as artists who want to make money from your art. And you look around you and you go, there are at least 1,000 artists on the smartest teleconference alone. And whilst we are all one creative community, we are also competitors. So how do you differentiate yourself from everybody else who is here on this call? Let me tell you now about the third quadrant, the how do you get it out into the world? And again, I think there are three levers here for you to consider. And by the way, I think this is a really juicy quadrant. I think this is something that you guys should be thinking about in terms of how do I get more creative about this? Because what I make up about the way art works is you look at how you get your art out into the world and you go, there are only three bleedingly obvious channels. One is, you know, art fairs. One is finding a dealer. And then maybe one is putting stuff on the internet. And those are the three and only three ways of selling my art. So the three levers here are in terms of how do you use it or how do you get it out into the world is the people, the experience that you create, and the distribution channels that you want to talk about. Now, let me tell you about the experience one first. So there is, I come from Australia originally. So Australia, amongst other things for being a great country, has great wine. So when I moved to Canada 6 or 7 years ago, and I got told that Canada had a wine industry, I was suitably mocking. Who's ever heard of Canadian wine if you're not a Canadian? However, I have to say that there is some pretty decent wine out and around in Canada and in my home province of Ontario. So a couple of years ago, I went on a wine tour down by the bench, it's called, down by Niagara, sort of close to Niagara Falls. And there's 30 or 40 different wineries down there. Now, you've probably gone on a wine tour yourself, and you sort of know what the experience is like. You drive up, there's some sort of pseudo-French chateau-y looking thing, sort of designed to look old and established and, you know, winery-like. And you walk in, and there's some sort of slightly surly teenager behind the bar who's slopping wine into little tasting glasses, knowing that, one, you don't really know anything about how to taste wine, and that, two, the law of reciprocity means that if you give people a little taste of wine, they start feeling morally obliged to buy bottles of wine. So it's a business strategy for them. But the truth is, if you're doing a winery tour, after a while, all of these wineries blend into one. Same sort of facade, same sort of serving experience, same what type of wine, same sort of guilt about buying or not buying a bottle of wine, and you're done. But there is a winery in Ontario that really played with this experience and created a really differentiated experience for me. It's a guy called Daniel Lenko. Now, his wines are very nice, but they're not that different from everybody else's wines. And as you show up to his winery, there is no pseudo-French chateau-looking thing. There's only the guy's sort of clapboard house. So you look around, and in a puzzled way, you go up to the front door, and you knock, and you go, where's the wine tasting experience? And you actually get shown in, and you sit in his kitchen. And so you're sitting around the kitchen table, which is big enough for eight people, and his mum comes out and serves you, depending on the day, peanut butter cookies or some sausage or some sort of snack. And you sit there with Daniel Lenko in his kitchen, and you drink his wine, and you eat his mum's food. And his mum talks a lot, and you know, when I was there, she like rushed out and got a tea towel showing her Australian people had come to visit her. And the point is, the wine is the same, but the experience is unique. And that is how I receive that product and service that's being offered. So you can imagine that when friends come to visit and they say they want to do a wine tour, I say, look, happy to do a wine tour. If there's one place we have to visit, it is Daniel Lenko's. Not because the wine is great, but because the experience is wonderful. So here's what I'm wondering. What experience do you create around your art? Is it, here's my picture, look at it. Here's my sculpture, look at it. Here is my drawing, look at it. Here's my photograph, look at it. Or do you create something else? When you approach a distributor, a dealer, do you send them photographs? Do you does your approach to that dealer look exactly the same as everybody else's approach to that dealer? Or do you do something that really stands out so that when the dealer is opening up, introduced to you for the first time, they go, well, you know, the photography is good, but the experience I got when I saw their photography for the first time was extraordinary. And that's what makes you stand out from the crowd. I also want to talk to you about distribution. So let me give you an example of another highly commoditized product, which is bottled water. Now, hands up all those people who, in a blind test, can tell any difference between any of the many bottled waters out there. And all of those who've got their hands up, you're lying. Anyway, so Coca-Cola is one of those big companies that now produces bottled water, along with Nestle and all the other big food giants. And in North America, at least, the brand for the Coca-Cola water is called Dasani. And when you see the advertising, it's like, you know, filtered five times and super pure or something like that. But the secret to their business is not how good the water is, because it's the same as everybody else's. It's not how much they charge for it, because they charge the same as everybody else's. It's not who they're selling it to, because they're selling it pretty much to, you know, Joe Blow the public, so it's not that. The secret to their success is their distribution. Because they say to shops and to shopkeepers, if you want to sell Coke, something that people come into your store to buy, you have to sell Dasani, and nothing but Dasani is your bottled water. So part of the question for you is, how can you get your product distributed in a different way? The example I have on the handout is Netflix, who I'm not sure if you have this in the UK yet or Australia, but in the US, Netflix is basically revolutionizing how you rent DVDs, because it's no longer the blockbuster experience where you show up to the store, you immediately forget every title that you thought you wanted to see, you're given, you know, the wall of the latest greatest hits, and you sort of walk away with a less great choice, and then it's due back in 3 days' time, probably with late fees. With Netflix, you have a list of your top 400 favorite DVDs. They mail them to your top three to you. When you're done watching your top three, and you can take as long as you want, you mail them back, and they send you your next top three. Meanwhile, you pay a monthly fee, a monthly membership fee. So part of what I'm thinking in terms of art is, what are the distribution channels for your art? How do you get them out into the world? And I'll tell you that something I experienced today. So my wife and I are in the market for a immediately forgot the name of it. It's the thingy that goes behind a bed. So a bed, the top of the bed, so it's got some sort of framing to the bed. There you go. Quick brain. So a headboard. That's the word I'm looking for. I'm in the market for a headboard. So I go to all the bed shops, and they're all boring, right? They're all wrought iron or a chunk of wood, and they're just totally underwhelming. I discovered today on the website, it's called the One and Only Custom Headboards. It's a website, and what they do is they convert art into headboards, and they sell it. Now, to buy a custom headboard from them, about $1,000, and I'm interested. And before, my budget was $200 for a whatever any old headboard would do. So part of how I want you to be thinking about your art is, how else do I get my art out to the world? How else do I get my art out to the world? Now, in terms of the final lever here, the people, the example I've got here is Turnaround Couriers, which are a local Toronto courier. Now, again, couriers, what's the difference between all the bike couriers in the world? Do they deliver packages any better? Nope, they're pretty much all the same. Do they charge any differently? Nope, they're pretty much charged the same. Is there any magical way that they cycle differently? Nope, they all do that pretty much the same. Do they target different people? Not really. They're all trying to get businesses to use couriers to take packages from one place to another. So what differentiates this bike courier? What differentiates it is it hires at-risk youth to be its bike couriers. So me as a small businessman, if I want to use a courier, I am going to go, there's no difference between the couriers except for this one. They use different, better, they do different people. And that's enough to differentiate them from everybody else in the market and get my business. Now, I struggled a bit to work out how to apply the people thing to your art. So you'll just have to figure that out yourself. But it is another lever that other businesses have used. And let me come now to the fourth quadrant, the how much piece. So how much? And there are three levers for you to be thinking about here. One is combinations. Secondly is cheaper. And the thirdly is more expensive. So I am sure you have heard of McDonald's. And however you feel about fast food, and in particular McDonald's fast food, and I have to tell you, I'm probably one of the few people on the planet who haven't eaten a McDonald's hamburger, so I'm no fan, but I really admire their business, because there's something that they do with how you buy a burger from them that makes them a lot of money. It's called the combo. So when you go into a McDonald's, it is very hard for you to buy just a hamburger, or just a drink, or just a serve of fries. What they sell and what they have on their menu board are Happy Meals, or Combo 1, or Combo 3. And it's the burger, the drink, and the fries, and the apple pie, or whatever it is that they sell. And what they have done is they have bundled things together as a way of getting people to leap up a price bracket. So what I'm wondering is, as you think about your art, how do you cluster it? How do you combo it? How do you make it an irresistible combination so that people go, well, I wasn't going to spend $100 on this photograph, but now there's a photograph, now there's a 10 postcards that go with it, and now there is a poster of the framed photograph, and it's $199. That is something I'm interested in buying because it's got a whole bunch of other stuff which I'm willing to upgrade my selection for. So that's the combo. Now I want to talk to you about cheaper. Now, I'm sure some of you are going, you know, man, I already practically give my art away. I don't want to make my prices any cheaper. But that's the wrong place to be starting, because actually where you're starting there is with the what, not the how much. So the creative question for the how much is, if you had to sell your art for $5 a shot, how would you make money from that? If you had to sell your art for $5 a shot, how much would you make? How would you make money from that? Or even more radically, if you had to give your art away, how would you make money from that? And a place to look here is for ING Direct, which is a Dutch bank, one of the five biggest banks in the world. And certainly in where I've seen them, which is North America and the UK and Europe, their big thing is it's free banking. And they say, look at the other banks. You pay a monthly fee. They gouge you on the interest rate. It's a disaster. And what they have done is they've said, if we had to give our banking away for free, how would we make money? So what they do is they offer only online banking. So there's no overhead, no branches, no tellers, no ATMs to keep up. They offer great interest rate, better than normal. And they make their money through things like loans and mortgages. So they're really clear that you give the banking away for free and you find different ways to make money from the people you build the relationships with. So, of course, this is useful to think of in terms of the combo piece as well, which is what is your full range of offering? What's the giveaway so that you can make money on the back end, as they call it? And let me tell you the final lever, which is expensive. And you'll see on the slide, which I guess is slide, let's see, 11, you'll see a couple of phones there. And in those phones, you have the two most expensive phones in the world. And they're made by Nokia. And they're sort of variations of the same phone. The one on the left is called the Nokia Virtue. And last time I looked, the Nokia... Well, actually, what I'd like you to do, if you have a pen and a paper, write down how much you think the Nokia Virtue sells for. So just jot down a figure. It's the most expensive phone in the world, so you know it's not going to be cheap. But how much do you think it's actually selling for? And let me tell you this. It sells for $21,000. Now, even though I can't hear you, I can hear a gasp down the phone, and secondly, across everybody's brain goes this question. What on earth does it do for $21,000? And you know what? That totally misses the point. It is not about what does it do. It's about what does it look like? What does it feel like? Here's a starting point. So if I had to sell a phone for $21,000, what would it have to look like? Well, it would have to be beautiful. But you know there's no added services you can add that makes it worth $21,000. But then the next question to ask is, who would buy a $21,000 phone? And the answer is, there are a lot of very wealthy people out there who don't want common phones. So it's the Paris Hiltons of the world who buy $21,000 phones. So how do you get it out there? Well, you get it out by targeting a certain elite type of person. Now, the phone next to it, which is a version of the Virtue, it's called It's called the Cobra or something like that. And although you can't see it in the picture, it's encrusted with rubies and it has two bejeweled snakes going up the side of it. That phone, of which there are just eight being produced, sells for $400,000. So far of the eight, two have been produced. Six of the eight have been pre-ordered. So even whilst for us, you know, common people, for want of a better word, we're all going, they're giving away phones so that they bundle it. The combination is with the annual plan that goes with the phone. Another business model is sell extraordinarily expensive phones. So the question is for you, if I was to sell my artwork for $10,000, what would it have to be? Who would I sell it to? How would I get it out into the world? Those are the business model questions. And you can see that once you start in one place with these quadrants, what it does is it takes you on an exploration, on a journey to start, say, what would have to happen for this to work? And that's not to say every idea you have turns into a successful business model. But what it does do is it opens up possibilities for you. Because at the moment, most of you are starting in the what. I've got my painting. Then you may think about the who, and you go, well, I've just got to try and sell it through my usual route, the dealer, actually through the what, through the how. How do I get it out there? Well, I sell it, put it on my website, and then I take it to a dealer, and I get told what price to buy, or I price it right as the same as every other photograph that looks like this. and you're stuck in the same route and route as everybody else. So those are the 12 levers. I'm just looking at my time. We've got 2 minutes left. So I know that I've been talking like a mad thing and dumping stuff down the phone at you guys. So I hope it wasn't too quick and too overwhelming.
Ah, Michael, I think you just opened a lot of doors and windows and let the fresh air in.
Good.
Thank you so much.
A pleasure.
It was really great having you join Smartest this year. Artis, you are on the sixth day of the Smartest Telesummit 2008, and we've just finished the fourth day of our keynote presentations with Michael Bungie-Stanier, giving us many ideas to think about. If you have feedback for us, what could be working better or is working great, jump in on the Smart Work Forum and tell us, or email me at info@smartest-telesummit.com. We'll see everyone tomorrow, Friday 25th, for our very last day of Smartest 2008. We'll have Michael Woodward on licensing, Jennifer Loudon on organization and taking care of yourself, and America's foremost creativity coach, Eric Maisel. Same bridge line, different experts, all ready to help you balance your life and sell your art. Until tomorrow, this is Ariane, your host and moderator for Smartest. That's www.smartest-telesummit.com. Keep the majesty of who you are and what you do shining for us all. Goodbye.